1871. He'd handled 18th-century broadswords before. Neither the weight nor the length surprised him. The basket around the hilt was slightly bent, but not enough to interfere with fitting his hand inside the grip. He'd done that before, too. There was a considerable difference, though, beyond reverently placing an antique artifact into a museum display and picking up a length of sharpened metal with the conscious intent of driving it through a human body. "It's a bit battered," Fraser had told him, squinting critically down the length of the sword before handing it to him. "But the blade's well balanced. Try the feel of it to see if it suits." Feeling a total fool, he slipped his hand into the basket and struck a fencing pose based on the memories of Errol Flynn films. They were standing in the busy lane outside the smithy in Cross Creek, and a few passers-by paused to watch and offer helpful comment.
"What's more asking for that bit of pot tin?" someone asked disparagingly. "Anything more than 2 shillings and it's highway robbery." "That's a fine sword," said Moore, leaning over the half-door of his forge and glowering. "I had it from my uncle, who saw service at Fort Stanwyck. Why, that blade's killed a many Frenchmen, and no but the one wee nick to be seen in it." "One nick?" cried the disparager. "Why, the thing's so bent, if you went to stick a man, you'd end up cutting off his ear."
There was a laugh from the gathering crowd that drowned the smith's response. Roger lowered the point of the sword, raised it slowly. How the hell did one road test a sword? Ought he to wave it to and fro, stick something with it? There was a cart standing a little way down the lane, loaded with burlap bags of something, raw wool from the smell. He looked for the proprietor of the bags, but couldn't pick him out from the growing crowd. The huge draft horse hitched to the cart was unattended, ears twitching sleepily over his dropped reins.
"Ah, if it's a sword the young man's wanting, sure, and Malachy McCabe has a better one than that, left from his service. I think he'd part with it for nay more than 3 shillings.
The cobbler from across the lane pursed his lips, nodding shrewdly at the sword.
"'Tisn't an elegant piece," one middle-aged ex-soldier agreed, head tilted on one side. "Serviceable, though, I grant you that."
Roger extended his arm, lunged toward the door of the smithy, and narrowly missed Moore coming out to defend the quality of his wares. The smith leapt aside with a startled cry, and the crowd roared. Roger's apology was interrupted by a loud nasal voice behind him.
"Here, sir, let me offer a foe more worthy of your steel than an unarmed smith."
Whirling round, Roger found himself confronting Dr. Fentiman, who was pulling a long, thin blade from the head of his ornamental cane. The doctor, who was roughly half Roger's size, brandished his rapier with a genial ferocity. Obviously fueled by a liberal luncheon, the tip of his nose glowed like a Christmas bulb.
"A test of skill, sir?"
The doctor whipped his sword to and fro, so the narrow blade sang as it cut the air.
"First to pink his man, first to draw blood is the victor. What do you say?" "Oh, an unfair advantage to the doctor. And isn't drawing blood your business, then?" "Ha-ha, and if you run him through instead of pinking him, will you patch the hole for no charge?" yelled another onlooker. "Or are you out to drum up business, leech? Watch yourself, young man. Turn your back on him, and he's like to give you a clyster. Better a clyster than a blade up the arse."
The doctor ignored these and similar vulgar observations, holding his blade upright in readiness. Roger shot a glance at Jamie, who was leaning against the wall, looking amused. Jamie raised one eyebrow and shrugged slightly.
"Try the feel of it," Jamie had said.
Well, then he supposed a duel with a drunken midget was as good a test as any.
Roger raised his blade and fixed the doctor with a menacing look.
"On guard," he said.
And the knot of onlookers roared approval.
"Gardez-vous,"
replied the doctor promptly, and lunged. Roger spun on one heel, and the doctor shot past, rapier pointed like a lance. Moore, the smith, leapt aside just in time to avoid being skewered for the second time, cursing fluently.
"Why am I a frigging target?" he shouted, shaking a fist.
Disregarding the near miss, the doctor regained his balance and charged back toward Roger, uttering shrill cries of self-encouragement. It was rather like being attacked by a wasp, Roger thought. If you didn't panic, you found it possible to follow the thing and bat it away.
Perhaps the doctor was a decent swordsman when sober. In his current state, his frenzied thrusts and mad flurries were easily fended off, as long as Roger paid attention. It occurred to him early on that he could end the contest at any time, merely by meeting the doctor's slender rapier edge-on with his own much heavier weapon. He was beginning to enjoy himself, though, and was careful to parry with the flat of the broadsword. Gradually, everything disappeared from Roger's view but the flashing point of the rapier. The shouts of the crowd faded to a bee buzz. The dirt of the lane and the wall of the smithy were scarcely visible. He grazed his elbow on the wall, moved back, moved in a circle to gain more room, all without conscious thought. The rapier beat on his wider blade, engaged and screeched loose with a whing of metal. Clang and click and the whish of empty air and the ringing beat that vibrated in his wrist bones with every blow of the doctor's sword. Watch the stroke, follow it, bat it away. He had no idea what he was doing, but did it anyway. The sweat was running in his eyes. He shook his head to fling it away, nearly missed a low lunge toward his thigh, stopped it close and flung the rapier back. The doctor staggered, thrown off balance, and feral shouts of, "Now, take him, stick him now," rang in the dust-filled air. He saw the expanse of the doctor's embroidered waistcoat unguarded, filled with silken butterflies, and choked back the visceral urge to lunge for it. Shaken by the intensity of the urge, he took a step back. The doctor, sensing weakness, leapt forward, bellowing, blade pointed. Roger took a half-step sideways, and the doctor shot past, grazing the hock of the draft horse in his path. The horse emitted an outraged scream and promptly sent swordsman and sword flying through the air to crash against the front of the cobbler's shop. The doctor fell to the ground like a crushed fly, surrounded by lasts and scattered shoes. Roger stood still, panting. His whole body was pulsing with every heartbeat, hot with the fighting. He wanted to go on. He wanted to laugh. He wanted to hit something. He wanted to get Brianna up against the nearest wall, and now. Jamie gently lifted his hand and pried his fingers from the hilt of the sword. He hadn't remembered he was holding it. His arm felt too light without it, as though it might fly up toward the sky all by itself. His fingers were stiff from gripping it so hard, and he flexed them automatically, feeling the tingle as the blood came back. The blood was tingling everywhere. He hardly heard the laughter, the offers of drinks, or felt the blows of congratulation rained on his back. "A clyster! A clyster! Give him a clyster!" a gang of apprentices was chanting, following along as the doctor was borne off for first aid in the nearest tavern. The horse's owner was fussing solicitously over the big bay, who looked more bemused than injured.
"I suppose he's won. After all, he drew first blood."
Roger didn't realise that he'd spoken until he heard his own voice, strangely calm in his ears.
"Will it do?"
Jamie was looking at him in question, the sword held lightly on the palms of his hands. Roger nodded. The lane was bright and filled with white dust. It gritted under his eyelids, between his teeth, when he closed his mouth.
"Aye," he said, "it will do."
"Good," said Jamie.
"So will you,"
he added casually, turning away to pay the smith.
This ends Disc 36. The Fiery Cross, Disc 37.
Part 8. A Hunting We Will Go. Chapter 89. The Moons of Jupiter. Late November, 1771. For the fourth time in as many minutes, Roger assured himself that it wasn't medically possible to die of sexual frustration. He doubted that it would even cause lasting damage. On the other hand, it wasn't doing him any great good either, in spite of his efforts to consider it as an exercise in building character. He eased himself onto his back, careful of the rustling mattress, and stared at the ceiling. No good. From a crack at the edge of the oiled hide covering the window, early morning sun was streaming in across the bed, and from the corner of his eye he could still see the pure golden haunches of his wife,
lit as though spotlighted. She was lying on her stomach, face buried in the pillow, and the linen sheet had slipped down past the swell of her buttocks, leaving her bare from her nape to the crack of her arse. She lay so close in the narrow bed that his leg touched hers, and the warmth of her breathing brushed his bare shoulder. His mouth was dry. He closed his eyes. That didn't help. He promptly started seeing images of the night before. Brianna by the dim light of a smothered fire, the flames of her hair sparking in the shadows. Light gleaming sudden across the curve of a naked breast as she slipped the butter-soft linen from her shoulders. Late as it was, tired as he was, he'd wanted her desperately. Someone else had wanted her more, though. He'd cracked an eyelid and raised himself just slightly, enough to see over Brianna's tumbled red locks to where the cradle stood against the wall, still in shadow. No sign of movement. They had a long-standing agreement. He woke instantly when disturbed. She was groggy and maladroit. So when a siren shriek from the cradle jerked him into heart-pounding alertness, it was Roger who would rise, pick up the soggy, yowling bundle, and deal with the immediate necessities of hygiene. By the time he brought Jemmy to his mother, bucking and squirming in the search for sustenance, Brianna would have roused herself far enough to wriggle free of her gown and would reach up for the child, drawing him down in warm dark to the murmuring milky refuge of her body. Now that Jem was older, he seldom woke at night, but when he did, with bellyache or nightmare, it took a lot longer to settle him back to sleep than it had when he was tiny. Roger had fallen back to sleep while Bree was still administering comfort, but woke when she turned in the narrow bed, her buttocks sliding past his thigh. The corn shucks under them crackled loudly with a noise like a thousand distant firecrackers, all going off down the length of his spine, waking him to full awareness of an urgent, nearly painful arousal. He'd felt the pressure of her arse against him, and narrowly restrained himself from rolling over and assaulting her from the rear. Small, suckling sounds from the other side of her body stopped him. Jem was still in their bed. He'd lain still, listening, praying that she'd stay awake long enough to return the little bugger to his cradle. Sometimes they fell asleep together, mother and child, and Roger would wake in the morning to the confusingly mingled scents of a beddable woman and baby pee. And then, in the end, he'd fallen asleep himself, in spite of his discomfort, worn out from a day of felling logs on the mountainside. He inhaled gently. No, she'd put him back. No scent in his bed now save Brianna's, the earthy smell of woman flesh, a faint sweet cloud of sweat and slippery willingness. She sighed in her sleep, murmured something incomprehensible, and turned her head on the pillow. There were blue smudges under her eyes. She'd been up late making jelly, up again twice more with a little with the baby. How could he wake her, only to gratify his own base urges? How could he not? He gritted his teeth, torn between temptation, compassion, and the sure conviction that if he yielded to his inclinations, he would get precisely as far as the worst possible moment before an interruption from the vicinity of the cradle compelled him to stop. Experience had been a harsh teacher, but the urgings of the flesh were louder than the voice of reason. He put out a stealthy hand and gently grasped the buttock nearest. It was cool and smooth and round as a gourd. She made a small noise deep in her throat and stretched luxuriously. She arched her back, pushing her backside up in a way that convinced Roger that the course of wisdom was to fling back the quilt, roll on top of her, and achieve his goal in the 10 seconds flat it was likely to take. He got as far as flinging back the quilt. As he raised his head from the pillow, a round, pale object rose slowly into view over the rim of the cradle, like one of the moons of Jupiter. A pair of blue eyes regarded him with clinical dispassion. "Oh, shit!" he said. "Oh, shit!" Jemmy said in happy mimicry. He clambered to his feet and stood, bouncing up and down as he gripped the edge of the cradle he was rapidly outgrowing, chanting, "Chit, chit, chit, chit," in what he evidently thought was a song.
Brianna jerked into wakefulness, blinking through tangled locks.
What? What's wrong?
Something stung me.
Roger flipped the edge of the quilt discreetly back in place.
Must be a wasp in here.
She stretched on her pillow, groaning and smoothing her hair out of her face with one hand, then picked up the cup from the table and took a drink. She always woke up thirsty. Her eyes travelled over him, and a slow smile spread across her wide, soft mouth.
Yeah? Nasty sting you got there. Want me to rub it?
She put down the cup, rolled gracefully up onto an elbow, and reached out a hand.
You're a sadist, Roger said, gritting his teeth. No doubt about it. You must get it from your father.
She laughed, took her hand off the quilt, and stood up, pulling her shift on over her head.
Mama! Chick, Mama!
Jemmy informed her, beaming as she swung him up out of his cradle with a grunt of effort.
You rat, she said affectionately. You aren't very popular with Daddy this morning. Your timing stinks.
She wrinkled her nose. And not only your timing.
Depends on your perspective, I suppose.
Roger rolled onto his side, watching.
I imagine from his point of view the timing was perfect.
Yeah.
Brianna gave him a raised brow.
Hence the new word, huh?
He's heard it before, Roger said dryly, many times.
He sat up, swinging his legs out of bed, and rubbed a hand through his hair and over his face.
Well, all we have to do now is figure out how to get from the abstract to the concrete, huh?
She put Jemmy on his feet and knelt in front of him, kissing him on the nose, then unpinning his diaper.
Ooh, yak! Is 18 months too soon for toilet training, do you think?
Are you asking me or him?
Phew, I don't care. Whichever one of you has an opinion.
Jemmy plainly didn't. Cheerfully stoic, he was ignoring his mother's determined assault on his private parts with a cold, wet cloth, absorbed in a new song of his own composition, which went along the lines of pew, pew, chick, chick, pew, pew. Brianna put a stop to this by swinging him up in her arms and sitting down with him in the nursing chair by the hearth.
Want snackies? She said,
pulling down the neck of her shift invitingly.
God, yes, Roger said with feeling.
Bree laughed, not without sympathy, as she settled Jemmy on her lap, where he settled happily to suckling.
Your turn next, she assured Roger. You want oatmeal porridge or fried mush for breakfast?
Anything else on the menu?
Damn,
he'd be nearly ready to stand up. Back to square one.
Oh, sure. Toast with strawberry jam, cheese, eggs, but you'll have to go get them from the coop. I don't have any in the pantry.
Roger found it hard to concentrate on the discussion, faced with the sight of Brianna in the dim, smoky light of the cabin, long thighs spread under her shift, her heels tucked under the chair. She seemed to detect his lack of interest in matters dietary, for she looked up and smiled at him, her eyes taking in his own nakedness.
You look nice, Roger, she said softly.
Her free hand drifted down, resting lightly on the inner curve of one thigh. The long, blunt-nailed fingers made slow circles, barely moving.
So do you?
His voice was husky.
Better than nice.
Her hand rose and patted Jemmy softly on the back.
Want to go see Auntie Lizzie after breakfast, sweetie? She asked, not looking at him.
Her eyes were fixed on Roger's, and her wide mouth curved in a slow smile.
He didn't think he could wait until after breakfast to touch her, at least.
Her shawl was thrown across the foot of the bed. He grabbed it and wrapped it round his hips for the sake of decency as he got out of bed and crossed to kneel beside her chair. Her hair stirred and lifted in a draught from the window, and he saw the stipple of goose flesh break out suddenly on her arms. He put his arms around them both. The draught was cold on his bare back, but he didn't care.
I love you,
he whispered in her ear. His hand lay over hers, resting on her thigh. She turned her head and kissed him, a glancing contact of soft lips.
I love you too, she said.
She had rinsed her mouth with water and wine and tasted of autumn grapes and cold streams. He was just settling down to more serious business when a loud hammering shivered the timbers of the door, accompanied by his father-in-law's voice.
"Roger, are you in there, man? Up with you this minute." "What does he mean, am I in here?"
Roger hissed to Brianna.
"Where the hell else would I be?"
"Shh." She nipped his neck and reluctantly let go, her eyes travelling over him with deep appreciation. "He's already up, da," she called.
"Aye, and it's likely to be a permanent condition, too," Roger muttered. "Coming," he bellowed. "Where the hell are my clothes?"
"Under the bed where you left them last night."
Brianna set down Jemmy, who shrieked ecstatically at the sound of his grandfather's voice, and ran to pound on the bolted door. Having finally ventured to walk, he had lost no time with the next stage, moving on to rapid and perpetual locomotion within a matter of days.
"Hurry!"
Sunlight flooded into the cabin as the hide over the window was thrust aside, revealing Jamie Fraser's broad-boned face, flushed with excitement and morning sun. He lifted an eyebrow at the view of Roger thus revealed, crouched on the floor, with a shirt clutched protectively to his midsection.
"Move yourself, man," he said mildly. "It's no time to be hanging about bare-arsed. MacLeod says there are beasts just over the ridge."
He blew a kiss to Jemmy. Roger forgot both sex and self-consciousness. He jerked the shirt over his head and stood up.
"What kind? Deer? Elk? I dinna ken, but they're meat."
The hide dropped suddenly, leaving the room half in shadow. The intrusion had let in a blast of cold air, breaking the warm, smoke-laden atmosphere, and bringing with it the breath of hunting weather, of crisp wind and crimson leaves, of mud and fresh droppings, of wet wool and sleek hide, all spiced with the imaginary reek of gunpowder. With a final, longing look at his wife's body, Roger grabbed his stockings. Chapter 90. Danger in the Grass. Grunting and puffing, the men pushed into the dark green zone of the conifers by noon. High on the upper ridges, clusters of balsam fir and hemlock huddled with spruce and pine over the tumbled rock. Here they stood, secure in seasonal immortality, needles murmuring lament for the bright fragility of the fallen leaves below. Roger shivered in the cold shadow of the conifers and was glad of the thick wool hunting shirt he wore over the linen one. There was no conversation. Even when they paused briefly to draw breath, there was a stillness in the wood here that forbade unnecessary speech. The wilderness around them felt calm and empty. Perhaps they were too late and the game had moved on. Perhaps MacLeod had been wrong. Roger hadn't yet mastered the killing skills, but he had spent a good deal of time alone in sun and wind and silence. He had acquired some of the instincts of a hunter. The men came out into full sun as they emerged on the far side of the ridge. The air was thin and cold, but Roger felt heat strike through his chilled body and closed his eyes in momentary pleasure. The men paused together in unspoken appreciation, basking in a sheltered spot, momentarily safe from the wind. Jamie stepped to the edge of a rocky shelf, sun glinting off his tailed copper hair. He turned to and fro, squinting downward through the trees. Roger saw his nostrils flare and smiled to himself. Well then, perhaps he did smell the game. He wouldn't be surprised. Roger sniffed experimentally, but got nothing but the must of decaying leaves and a strong whiff of well-aged perspiration from the body of Kenny Lindsay. Fraser shook his head, then turned to Fergus, and with a quiet word climbed over the edge of the shelf and disappeared.
"We wait,"
Fergus said laconically to the others, and sat down. He produced a pair of carved stone balls from his bag and sat rolling them to and fro in his palm, concentrating intently, rolling a sphere out and back along the length of each dexterous finger. A brilliant fall sun poked long fingers through the empty branches, administering the last rites of seasonal consolation, blessing the dying earth with a final touch of warmth. The men sat talking quietly, reeking in the sun. He hadn't noticed in the colder wood, but here in the sun the tang of fresh sweat was apparent, overlying the deeper layers of grime and body odours. Roger reflected that perhaps it wasn't extraordinary olfactory acuteness on the part of animals, but merely the extreme smelliness of human beings that made it so difficult to get near game on foot. He had sometimes seen the Mohawks rub themselves with herbs to disguise their natural odour when hunting, but even oil of peppermint wouldn't make a dent in Kenny Lindsay's stench. He didn't reek like that himself, did he? Curious, he bent his head toward the open neck of his shirt and breathed in. He felt a trickle of sweat run down the back of his neck, under his hair. He blotted it with his collar and resolved to bathe before going back to the cabin, no matter if the creek was crusted with ice. Showers and deodorants were of more than aesthetic importance, he reflected. One got used to almost any habitual stink in short order, after all. What he'd not realized, secure in his relatively odourless modern environment, were the more intimate implications of smell. Sometimes he felt like a bloody baboon, his most primitive responses unleashed without warning by some random assault of odour. He remembered what had happened just the week before, and felt a hot blush creep over him at the memory. He'd walked into the dairy looking for Claire. He'd found her, and Jamie too. They were both fully clothed, standing well apart, and the air was so filled with the musk of desire and the sharp scent of male completion that Roger had felt the blood burn in his face, the hair on his body prickling erect. His first instinct had been to turn and leave, but there was no excuse for that. He'd given his message to Claire, conscious of Fraser's eyes on him, bland and quizzical. Conscious, too, of the unspoken communication between the two of them, an unseen thrum in the air, as though they were two beads strung on a wire stretched tight. Jamie had waited until Roger left before leaving himself. From the corner of his eye, Roger had caught a slight movement, seen the light touch of the hand with which he left her, and even now felt a queer clutch of his insides at the memory. He blew out his breath to ease the tightness in his chest, then stretched out in the leaves, letting the sun beat down on his closed eyelids. He heard a muffled groan from Fergus, then the rustle of footsteps as the Frenchman made another hasty withdrawal. Fergus had eaten half-cured sauerkraut the night before, a fact made clear to anyone who sat near him for long. His thoughts drifted back to that awkward moment in the dairy shed. It wasn't prurience, nor even simple curiosity, and yet he often found himself watching them. He saw them from the cabin window, walking together in the evening, Jamie's head bent toward her, hands clasped behind his back. Claire's hands moved when she talked, rising long and white in the air, as though she would catch the future between them and give it shape. Would hand Jamie her thoughts as she spoke them, smooth and polished objects, bits of sculptured air. Once aware of what he was doing, Roger watched them purposefully and brushed aside any feelings of shame at such intrusion, minor as it was. He had a compelling reason for his curiosity. There was something he needed to know badly enough to excuse any lack of manners. How was it done, this business of marriage? He'd been brought up in a bachelor's house, given all he needed as a boy in terms of affection by his great-uncle and the Reverend's elderly housekeeper. He found himself lacking something as an adult, ignorant of the threads of touch and word that bound a married couple. Instinct would do for a start. But if love like that could be learned... A touch on his elbow startled him, and he jerked round, flinging out an arm in quick defence. Jamie ducked neatly, eluding the blow, and grinned at him. Fraser jerked his head toward the edge of the shelf. "I've found them," he said. Jamie raised a hand, and Fergus went at once to his side. The Frenchman came barely to the big Scot's shoulder, but didn't look ridiculous. He shaded his eyes with his one hand, peering down where Fraser pointed. Roger came up behind them, looking down the slope. A flicker shot through a clearing below, marked by the swooping dip and rise of its flight. Its mate called deep in the wood, a sound like a high-pitched laugh. He could see nothing else remarkable below. It was the same dense tangle of mountain laurel, hickory, and oak that existed on the side of the ridge from which they had come. Far below, a thick line of tall, leafless trees marked the course of a stream. Fraser saw him and gestured downward with a twist of the head, pointing with his chin.
"By the stream, d'ye see?" he said.
At first, Roger saw nothing. The stream itself wasn't visible, but he could chart its course by the growth of bare-limbed sycamore and willows. Then he saw it. A bush far down the slope moved in a way that wasn't like the wind-blown tossing of the branches near it. A sudden jerk that shook the bush as something pulled at it, feeding.
"Jesus, what's that?"
His glimpse of a sudden dark bulk had been enough only to tell him that the thing was big, very big.
"I dinna ken. Bigger than a deer. Were pity, maybe."
Fraser's eyes were intent, narrowed against the wind. He stood easy, musket in one hand, but Roger could see his excitement.
"A moose, perhaps?"
Fergus frowned under his shading hand.
"I have not seen one, but they are very large, no?"
"No." Roger shook his head.
"I mean, yes, but that's not what it is. I've hunted moose with the Mohawk. They don't move like that at all."
Too late, he saw Fraser's mouth tighten briefly, then relax. By unspoken consent, they avoided mention of Roger's captivity among the Mohawk. Fraser said nothing, though, only nodded at a tangle of woodland below.
"Aye, it's not deer or moose either. But there's more than one, do you see?"
Roger squinted harder, then saw what Fraser was doing, and did likewise, swaying from foot to foot, deliberately letting his eyes drift casually across the landscape. With no attempt to focus on a single spot in the panorama below, he could instead see the whole slope as a blurred patchwork of colour and motion.
"Like a Van Gogh painting," he thought,
and smiled at the thought. Then he saw what Jamie had seen and stiffened, all thoughts of modern art forgotten. Here and there, among the faded greys and browns and the patches of evergreen, was a disjunction, a knot in the pattern of nature's weft, strange movements not caused by the rushing wind. Each beast was invisible itself, but made its presence known nonetheless by the twitchings of the bushes nearby.
"God, how big must they be? There and there."
He let his eyes drift to and fro, and felt a tightening of excitement through chest and belly.
"Christ, there were half a dozen at least." "I was right. I was right, was a no McDo,"
MacLeod exulted. His round face beamed from one to another, flushed with triumph.
"I did see as I'd seen beasts, aye?" "Jesus, there's a whole herd of them,"
Evan Lindsay breathed, echoing his thought. The Highlander's face was bright, fierce with anticipation. He glanced at Jamie.
"How will it be, McDo?"
Jamie lifted one shoulder slightly, still peering into the valley.
"Hard to see. They're in the open. We can't corner them anywhere."
He licked a finger and held it to the breeze, then pointed.
"The wind's from the west. Let us come down the runnel there to the foot of the slope. Then we, Roger and I, will pass to the other side, near that great outcrop. You see the one?"
Lindsay nodded slowly, a crooked front tooth worrying the thin flesh of his lip.
"They're near the stream. Do you circle about, keep well clear until you're near to the big cedar tree. You see it? Aye. Then spread yourselves, two to each bank of the stream. Evan's the best marksman. Have him stand ready. Roger, Mac, and I will come behind the herd to drive them toward you."
Fergus nodded, surveying the land below.
"I see. And if they shall see us, they will turn into that small defile and so be trapped. Very good. Allons-y."
He gestured imperiously to the others, his hook gleaming in the sun. Then he grimaced slightly, hand to his belly, as a long, rumbling fart despoiled the silence of the wood. Jamie gave him a thoughtful look.
"Keep downwind, aye?" he said.
It was impossible to walk silently through the drifts of dry leaves. but Roger stepped as lightly as possible. Seeing Jamie load and prime his own gun, Roger had done likewise, feeling mingled excitement and misgivings at the acrid scent of powder. From his impressions of the size of the beasts they followed, even he might have a chance at hitting one. Putting aside his doubts, he paused for a moment, turning his head from side to side to listen. Nothing but the faint rush of wind through the bare branches overhead, and the far-off murmur of water. A small crack sounded in the underbrush ahead, and he caught a glimpse of red hair. He cupped the gun stock in his hand, the wood warm and solid in his palm, barrel aimed upward over his shoulder, and followed. Stealing carefully round a sumac bush, Roger felt something give suddenly under his foot and jerked back to keep his balance. He looked at what he'd stepped on, and in spite of his instant disappointment, felt a strong urge to laugh.
"Jamie,"
he called, not bothering any longer about stealth or silence. Fraser's bright hair appeared through a screen of laurel, followed by the man himself. He didn't speak, but lifted one thick brow in inquiry.
"I'm no great tracker," Roger said, nodding downward. "But I've stepped in enough of these to know one when I see one."
He scraped the side of his shoe on a fallen log and pointed with his toe.
"What do you think we've been creeping up on all this time?"
Jamie stopped short, squinting, then walked forward and squatted next to the corrugated brown splotch. He prodded it with a forefinger, then looked up at Roger with an expression of mingled amusement and dismay.
"I'll be damned," he said.
Still squatting, he turned his head, frowning as he surveyed the wilderness around them.
"What are they doing here?" he murmured.
He stood up, shading his eyes as he looked toward the creek where the lowering sun dazzled through the branches.
"That doesn't make a bit of sense," he said, squinting into the shadows.
"There are only three kine on the ridge, and I saw two of them being milked this morning. The third belongs to Bobby MacLeod, and I should think he'd ken if it was his own cow he'd seen. Besides..."
He turned slowly on his heel, looking up the steep slope they'd just descended. He didn't have to speak. No cow not equipped with a parachute could have come down that way.
"There's more than one. A lot more," Roger said. "You saw?"
"Aye, there are. But where did they come from?"
Jamie glanced at him, frowning in puzzlement.
"The Indians dinna keep kine, especially not at this season. They'd slaughter any beasts they had and smoke the meat. And there's no farm in 30 miles where they might have come from."
"Maybe a wild herd," Roger suggested. "Escaped a long time ago and wandering."
Speculation sprang up in Jamie's eyes, echoing the hopeful gurgle of Roger's stomach.
"If so, they'll be easy hunting," Jamie said.
Skepticism tempered his voice even as he smiled. He stooped and broke off a small piece of the cowpat, crushed it with a thumb, then tossed it away.
"Very fresh," he said. "They're close. Let's go."
Within a half hour's walking, they emerged onto the bank of the stream they had glimpsed from above. It was wide and shallow here, with willows trailing leafless branches in the water. Nothing moved, save a sparkle of sun on the riffles, but it was plain that the cows had been there. The mud of the bank was cut and churned with drying hoofprints, and in one place the dying plants had been poured away in a long, messy trough where something large had wallowed.
"Why did I not think to bring rope?" Jamie muttered, pushing through the willow saplings on the bank as they skirted the wallow. "Meat's one thing, but milk and cheese would be..."
The muttering died away as he turned from the stream, following a trail of broken foliage back into the wood. Without speaking, the two men spread out, walking softly. Roger listened with all his might to the quiet of the forest. They had to be nearby. Even such an inexperienced eye as Roger's had picked up the freshness of the signs. And yet the wood was autumn still, the silence broken only by a raven calling in the distance. The sun was hanging low in the sky, filling the air in the wood with a golden haze. It was getting noticeably colder. Roger passed through a patch of shadow and shivered in spite of his coat.
They'd have to find the others and make camp soon. Twilight was short. A fire would be good. Better, of course, if there was something to cook over it. They were going down now, into a small hollow where wisps of autumn mist rose from the cooling earth. Jamie was some distance ahead, walking with as much purpose as the broken ground allowed. Evidently the trail was still plain to him in spite of the thick vegetation. A herd of cows couldn't just vanish, he thought, even in mist as heavy as this. Not unless they were fairy kine. And that he wasn't quite prepared to believe, in spite of the unearthly quiet of the woods just here.
Roger.
Jamie spoke very quietly, but Roger had been listening so intently that he located his father-in-law at once, some distance to his right. Jamie jerked his head at something nearby.
Look.
He held aside a large brambly bush, exposing the trunk of a substantial sycamore tree. Part of the bark had been rubbed away, leaving an oozing whitish patch on the grey bark.
Do cows rub themselves like that?
Roger peered dubiously at the patch, then picked out a swatch of woolly dark hair snagged by the roughened bark.
Aye, sometimes, Jamie replied.
He leaned close, shaking his head as he peered at the dark brown tangle in Roger's hand.
But damned if I've ever seen a cow with a coat like that. Why, you'd think it was...
Something moved at Roger's elbow, and he turned to find a monstrous dark head peering over his shoulder. A tiny, blood-dark eye met his own, and he let out a yell and jerked backward. There was a loud bang as his gun went off, and then a rush and a thud, and he was lying wrapped round a tree trunk, the breath knocked out of him, left with no more than a fleeting notion of a hairy, dark bulk and a power that had sent him flying like a leaf. He sat up, fighting for breath, and found Jamie on his knees in the leaves, scrabbling frantically for Roger's gun.
Up, he said. Up, wee Roger. My God, it's buffalo.
Then he was up, following Jamie. Still half-winded but running, his gun in his hand with no clear memory of how it got there, powder horn bumping against his hip. Jamie was bounding like a deer through bushes, bundled cloak bouncing against his back. The wood wasn't silent any longer. Ahead there were crashings and splinterings and low snorting bellows. He caught up Jamie on the upward slope. They laboured up it, feet sliding on damp leaves, lungs burning from the effort, then topped a rise and came out onto a long downward slope scattered with spindly pine and hickory saplings. There they were, eight or nine of the huge shaggy beasts clustering together as they thundered down the hill, splitting to go round thickets and trees. Jamie dropped to one knee, sighted and fired, to no apparent effect. There was no time to stop and reload. They must keep the herd in sight. A bend of the stream glinted between the trees, below and to the right. Roger charged down the slope in a rush of excitement, canteen and bullet box flying, heart thundering like the hooves of the buffalo herd. He could hear Jamie bellowing behind him, shouting Gaelic exhortations. An exclamation in a different tone made Roger glance back. Jamie had stopped, his face frozen in shock. Before Roger could call to him, shock shifted to a look of fury. Teeth bared, he seized his gun by the barrel and brought down the stock with a vicious chunk. Barely pausing, he lifted the gun and clubbed it down again and again, shoulders rolling with the effort. Reluctantly abandoning the chase, Roger turned and bounded up the slope toward him.
What the hell?
Then he saw and felt the hair on his body rise in a surge of revulsion. Brown coils squirmed between the tussocks, thick and scaly. One end of the snake had been battered to pulp, and its blood stained the butt of Fraser's musket. But the body writhed on, worm-like and headless.
Stop, it's dead. Do you hear me? Stop, I say.
He grasped Fraser's arm, but his father-in-law jerked free of his hold and brought the gun butt down once more. Then he did stop, and stood shuddering violently, half leaning on his gun.
Christ, what happened? Did it get you?
Aye, in the leg. I stepped on it.
Jamie's face was white to the lips. He looked at the still writhing corpse, and a deep shudder ran through him again. Roger repressed his own shudder and grabbed Fraser's arm.
Come away. Sit down, we'll have a look.
Jamie came, half stumbling, and collapsed onto a fallen log. He fumbled at his stocking top, fingers shaking. Roger pushed Jamie's hand away and stripped buskin and stocking off the right foot. The fang marks were clear, a double dark red puncture in the flesh of Fraser's calf. The flesh around the small holes had a bluish tinge, visible even in the late gold light.
It's poisonous. I've got to cut it.
Roger felt dry-mouthed but oddly calm, with no sense of panic. He pulled the knife from his belt, thought briefly of sterilization, and dismissed the notion. It would take precious minutes to light a fire, and there was no time at all to waste.
Wait.
Fraser was still white, but had stopped shaking. He took the small flask from his belt and trickled whiskey over the blade, then poured a few drops on his fingers and rubbed the liquid over the wound. He gave Roger a brief twitch of the mouth, meant as a smile.
Claire does that when she sets herself to cut someone.
He leaned back, hands braced on the mossy trunk, and nodded.
Go on, then.
Biting his lip in concentration, Roger pressed the tip of the knife into the skin just above one of the puncture marks. The skin was surprisingly tough and springy. The knife dented it, but didn't penetrate. Fraser reached down and clasped his hand around Roger's. He shoved with a deep, vicious grunt, and the knife sank suddenly in, an inch or more. Blood welled up around the blade. The gripping hand fell away.
Again, hard and quick, man, for God's sake.
And Jamie's voice was steady, but Roger felt clear droplets of sweat fall onto his hand from Fraser's face, warm and then cold on his skin. He braced himself to the necessary force, stabbed hard and cut quick, two X marks over the punctures, just as the first aid guide said. The wounds were bleeding a lot, blood pouring down in thick streams. That was good, though, he thought. He had to go deep, deep enough to get beyond the poison. He dropped the knife and bent, mouth to the wounds. There was no panic, but his sense of urgency was rising. How fast did venom spread? He had no more than minutes, maybe less. Roger sucked as hard as he could, blood filling his mouth with the taste of hot metal. He sucked and spat in quiet frenzy, blood spattering on the yellow leaves, Fraser's leg hairs scratchy against his lips. With the peculiar diffusion of mind that attends emergency, he thought of a dozen fleeting things at once, even as he bent his whole concentration to the task at hand.
Was the bloody snake really dead? How poisonous was it? Had the bison got away? Christ, was he doing this right? Brianna would kill him if he let her father die. So would Claire. He had the devil of a cramp in his right thigh. Where in hell were the others? Fraser should call for them. No, he was calling, was bellowing somewhere outside Roger's ken.
The flesh of the leg Roger held had gone rock hard, muscles rigid under his pressing fingers. Something grasped the hair on the back of his head and twisted, forcing him to stop. He glanced up, breathing hard.
"That's enough, aye?"
Jamie said mildly.
"You'll drain me dry."
He gingerly wiggled his bared foot, grimacing at his leg. The slash marks were vivid, still oozing blood, and the flesh around them was swollen from the sucking, blotched and bruised. Roger sat back on his heels, gulping air.
I've made more of a mess than the snake did.
His mouth filled with saliva. He coughed and spat. Fraser silently offered him the whiskey flask. He swirled a mouthful round and spat once more, then drank deeply.
All right.
He wiped his chin with the back of a hand, still tasting iron, and nodded at the macerated leg.
I'll do.
Jamie was still pale, but one corner of his mouth turned up.
Go and see, are the others in sight?
They weren't. The view from the top of the outcrop showed nothing but a sea of bare branches tossing to and fro. The wind had come up. If the bison still moved along the river, there was no trace visible, either of them or of their hunters. Hoarse from hallooing into the wind, Roger made his way back down the slope. Jamie had moved a little, finding a sheltered spot among rocks at the foot of a big balsam fir. He was sitting, back against a rock and legs outstretched, a handkerchief bound round his wounded leg.
No sign of anyone. Can you walk?
Roger bent over his father-in-law and was alarmed to see him flushed and sweating heavily, despite the gathering chill of the air. Jamie shook his head and gestured toward his leg.
I can, but not for long.
The leg was noticeably swollen near the bite, and the blue tinge had spread. It showed like a faint fresh bruise on either side of the encircling handkerchief. Roger felt the first stab of uneasiness. He'd done everything he knew to do. First aid guides always had as the next step in the treatment of snake bite, immobilize limb and get patient to hospital as soon as possible. The cutting and sucking were meant to pull poison from the wound, but clearly there was still plenty left, spreading slowly through Jamie Fraser's body. He hadn't been in time to get it all, if he'd gotten any. And the nearest thing to a hospital, Claire and her herbs, a day's walk away. Roger sank slowly down onto his haunches, wondering what the hell to do next. Immobilize the limb. Well, that was effectively taken care of, for what good it might do.
Hurt much? He asked awkwardly. Yes.
With this unhelpful response, Jamie leaned back against the rock and closed his eyes. Roger eased himself down onto a sheaf of dry needles, trying to think. It was getting dark fast. The brief warmth of the day had faded, and the shadows under the trees had taken on the deep blue look of evening, though it couldn't be more than 4 or so. Plainly, they weren't going anywhere tonight. Navigation in the mountains was nearly impossible in the dark, even if Fraser could walk. If the others were here, they could make a shift to carry him, but would that be any better than leaving him where he was? While he urgently wished Claire were here, sense told him there was little even she could do, except, perhaps, comfort Jamie, if he were to die. The thought knotted his belly. Shoving it firmly aside, he reached into his pouch, checking supplies. He had a small quantity of Johnny Cake still in his bag. Water was never a difficulty in these mountains. Through the sound of the trees, he could hear the gurgle of a stream somewhere below, not far off. He'd better be gathering wood while it was still light, though.
We'd best make a fire.
Jamie spoke suddenly, startling Roger with this echo of his thought. Jamie opened his eyes and looked down at one hand, turning it over and back as though he'd never seen it before.
"Have pins and needles in my fingers?" he remarked with interest.
He touched his face with one hand.
"Here, too. My lips have gone numb. Is that usual, d'ye ken? I don't know. I suppose it is if you've been drinking the whisky."
It was a feeble joke, but he was relieved to have it greeted with a faint laugh.
"Nay."
Jamie touched the flask beside him.
"I thought I might need it more later."
Roger took a deep breath and stood up.
"Right. Stay there. You shouldn't move. I'll fetch along some wood. The others will likely see the light of the fire."
The other men would be of no particular help, at least not until morning, but it would be a comfort not to be alone.
"Fetch the snake, too," Jamie called after him. "Fair's fair. We'll hear a bite of him for our supper."
Grinning in spite of present worry, Roger gave a reassuring wave and turned down the slope.
"What were the chances?" he asked himself,
stooping to wrest a thick pine knot from the soft wood of a rotted log. Fraser was a big man and in robust health. Surely he would survive. Yet folk did die of snake bite, and not infrequently. He'd heard only last week of a German woman near High Point, bent to pick up a stick of wood from her woodpile, struck full in the throat by a snake lying hidden there, dead in minutes. Reaching under a bush for a dry branch, just as this recollection came to him, he hastily withdrew his bare hand, goose flesh running up his arm. Berating himself for stupidity, he got a stick and thoroughly stirred the drift of dry leaves before reaching once more cautiously into it. He couldn't help glancing up the slope every few minutes, feeling a small stab of alarm whenever Fraser was out of sight. What if he should collapse before Roger returned? Then he relaxed a little as he remembered. No, it was all right. Jamie wasn't going to die tonight, either of snake bite or cold. He couldn't. He was meant to die some years hence, by fire. For once, future doom meant present reassurance. He took a deep breath and let it out in relief, then steeled himself to approach the snake. It was motionless now, quite obviously dead. Still, it took some effort of will to pick the thing up. It was as thick around as his wrist and nearly 4 feet long. It had begun to stiffen. In the end, he was obliged to lay it across the armload of firewood like a scaly branch. Seeing it so, he had no trouble imagining how the snake that had bitten the German woman had escaped notice. The subtle browns and greys of its patterns made it nearly invisible against its background. Jamie skinned the thing while Roger built the fire. Watching from the corner of his eye, he could see that his father-in-law was making an unusually clumsy job of it. The numbness in his hands must be getting worse. Still, he went on doggedly, hacking at the corpse, stringing chunks of pale raw flesh onto a half-peeled twig with trembling fingers. The job complete, Jamie extended the stick toward the budding fire and nearly dropped it. Roger grabbed for it and felt through the stick the tremor that shook Jamie's hand and arm.
"You all right?"
he said, and reached automatically to feel Jamie's forehead. Fraser jerked back, surprised and mildly affronted.
"Aye,"
he said, but then paused.
"Aye, well, I do feel a bit queer," he admitted.
It was hard to tell in the uncertain light, but Roger thought he looked a good bit more than queer.
"Lie down for a bit, why don't you?"
he suggested, trying to sound casual.
"Sleep if you can. I'll wake you when the food's ready."
Jamie didn't argue, which alarmed Roger more than anything else so far. He curled himself into a drift of leaves, moving his wounded leg with a care that told Roger just how painful it was. The snake meat dripped and sizzled, and in spite of a slight distaste at the notion of eating snake, Roger felt his stomach rumble in anticipation. Damned if it didn't smell like roasting chicken. Not for the first time, he reflected on the thin line that separated appetite from starvation. Give the most finicky gourmand a day or two without food, and he'd be eating slugs and lizards without the least hesitation. Roger had, on the journey back from his surveying trip. He kept an eye on Jamie. He didn't move, but Roger could see him shiver now and then in spite of the now leaping flames. His eyes were closed. His face looked red, but that might be only firelight. No telling his real colour. By the time the meat had cooked through, it was full dark. Roger fetched water, then heaped armloads of dried grass and wood on the fire, making the flames dance and crackle higher than his head. If the other men were anywhere within a mile, they should see it. Fraser roused himself with difficulty to eat. It was clear that he had no appetite, but he forced himself to chew and swallow, each bite a dogged effort. What was it? Roger wondered. Simple stubbornness? A notion of vengeance against the snake? Or perhaps some Highland superstition, the idea that consuming the reptile's flesh might be a cure for its bite?
"Did the Indians ken aught to do for snake bite?"
Jamie asked abruptly, lending some credence to the last guess.
"Yes," Roger answered cautiously. "They had roots and herbs that they mixed with dung or hot cornmeal to make a poultice." "Did it work?"
Fraser held a bit of meat in his hand, wrist drooping as though too tired to raise it to his mouth.
"I only saw it done twice. Once it seemed to work perfectly. No swelling, no pain. The little girl was quite all right by the evening of the same day. The other time, it didn't work."
He'd only seen the hide-wrapped body taken from the longhouse, not witnessed the grisly details of the death. Evidently, he was going to get another chance to see the effects of snake bite up close, though. Fraser grunted.
And what would they do in your time? Give you an injection of something called antivenin.